Rosetta.
Sweet Rosetta fat, she thought she was a cleaner, but she was a frying pan. The picker. Picture the fingers, great. Okay.
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Robert Morrison. He's a professor of English language and literature at Queen's University, Ontario. And we've talked to him about his incredible history about the Regency period. But tonight, we're going to be talking about rock and roll. Robert, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
This whole thing came out, a conversation we had after one of our conversations. And I was totally surprised, but we'll talk about that later. I want to inform the audience that you've just got an incredible you're going to be away in England for 4 years.
That's right. Yes, I was. Well, last time we spoke, I was just sort of living my life, and I applied for what's called a British Academy Global Professorship, and out of the blue, and much to my surprise and delight, I was awarded a global professorship. So next week, I am moving to Bath, England, and I'm going to be a British Academy Global Professor at Bath Spa University for the next 4 years. And I did my graduate work in England, and our eldest son was born in England, and I love being in Britain. I love being in Canada and America too, but I love living in England, and I'm looking very, very forward to being back there. And
what are your duties going to be involved? Are you going to also be researching something while you're there?
Yes, I'm going to. I've done quite a bit of work on a 19th century essayist and opium addict named Thomas De Quincey.
Oh, I know. I've heard of him. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wrote a biography of De Quincey, and I've worked on him quite a lot. And he's a fascinating figure. And he spent 3 years in Bath when he was a schoolboy, 1796 to 1799. And the other person, as you know from the Regency years, that fascinates me is Jane Austen. And Jane Austen also lived in Bath, and she set two of her novels there, of course, Northanger Abbey and Persuasion. And so De Quincey's letters have never been edited, and so some of them have, but not collected. And so I signed a contract with Oxford University Press to do De Quincey's letters, and then I applied to the British Academy and said, "Hey, man, how do you expect me to do that in Canada?" And they said, "You're quite right. You can't do that from Canada.
Oh, wow."
And so I said, "Yes, you're absolutely right. I'd be delighted to accept that." And so I have to spend time in the libraries of,
I have to spend. I love that.
I have to do that. I have to go to the archives and look at De Quincey letters, some of which have a little ring around them that De Quincey points to and says, "That's the opium I just spilled." The letters are in Edinburgh and in Grasmere in the Wordsworth Museum, and they're in York, and they're in Oxford, and they're in London. And several excellent collections in America as well, including at Houghton in Boston at Harvard. And so I'm going to collect all these letters and annotate them and introduce them, and the world is going to get a much broader look at the life of addiction that De Quincey led as an opium addict.
Well, and obviously we'll cover that on the show, but the reason we're here tonight, this is going to surprise everybody, I think, is we're here to talk about rock and roll.
Yes, let's talk about rock and roll. Jane Austen is a sideline for me, Mark.
Oh, please.
All I wanted, my whole career is built toward somebody saying to me, "Listen, let's talk about rock and roll." Jane Austen is a stepping stone.
Well, whenever you told me that you've written these essays that were published on, give the name of the journal.
The journal's called The Conversation. It's a journal where academics publish, but it's meant to be where academics publish with journalistic flair, which it is. It's a wonderful publication, and it's given me a chance to talk about things I really love, like Jane Austen, and wrote an essay on vampires a little while ago.
Yeah.
But it's also given me a chance to talk about the Beatles on the Rooftop and Elvis and Rod Stewart.
Now, wait a minute. I've seen your picture. You're not old enough to have remembered the Beatles when they were playing, are you?
No, I was.
So I'll be the voice of experience in this conversation as we go through.
All right, and I'm the eldest, but I
I want to ask you where this passion came. Because you're, first of all, you're very interested in the Beatles. We're going to be talking about two of your essays, one about John and Yoko and in Canada, and the other one is about the infamous, very famous, and rooftop concert. Where did you first learn, where did you first experience the Beatles, and where did you develop your passion for the Beatles?
I think I was thinking about that before we spoke, and I thought, and I think it was a friend named John who had an older brother named Adrian, and Adrian was, you know, 16 when I was 10, and he had Beatle posters up, and when we were, when I was playing with John, sometimes Adrian would come out and you could hear music out of his room, and I think I just thought that they just seemed better than everybody else. Even when I was 12, I just thought, what is going on there? And you know, then you find out a little bit more and a little bit more, and you know, I gradually figured out who Paul was and which voice was Paul's and which voice was John's, and oh my God, George wrote "Here Comes the Sun" and something. Is he getting enough credit for that? No, you know, etc. And what struck me about them, and still strikes me about them, the biggest thing is the everybody says this, I realize, but the speed of the development is just absolutely
well. It was amazing to live through, because the whole British invasion period, say from just before the middle of the 60s through to the end of the 60s, the Beatles were certainly, and the Stones were certainly the big, but you know, I remember in school, this is going to sound crazy, but we used to have your homeroom would like have to vote on who was the better band, the Beatles or the Dave Clark Five. I'm not kidding you.
Dear.
I know. I know.
What can be said about that?
Well, you know, it was, understand that here in America, and it may have been different in Canada, this was all new. I mean, this, remember, this really was a British invasion. And it was a lot fast, too soon. I mean, you got all these British invasion bands, which were just incredible. But then you're right. What happened is, as literally as the years went, and just a few years went by, all of a sudden, the sort of the quality of the Beatles' music would just sort of went off in a completely different direction.
I was three in 1964, so I don't have much of an impression of it. But one of my very favorite Canadian rock star singers is a guy named Burton Cummings. Burton Cummings led the Guess Who, and the Guess he wrote wrote with Randy Bachman. He wrote "American Woman" and "These Eyes" and "Laughing," and you know, he's got just an absolutely superb voice. And he was interviewed on you know, our version, Canadian version of Desert Island Discs, and he was asked about his career, and he described being in Winnipeg, Manitoba, when the Beatles hit. And he said, you know, there have been lots of things that have come along since then. Many, many innovative artists, many of them from America, of course. But he said there was absolutely nothing like watching Ed Sullivan in February 64.
I watched it. It
was the planet changed.
It's absolutely true. That was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And it's incredible to think back that there were other acts on the show, and I really pity the poor acts that were on the rest of that show.
That came after that,
The other thing that I have to say is, although a few other bands like Herman's Hermits made and the Dave Clark Five made films, the two films that came out in the 60s, Hard Day's Night, which was a groundbreaking film in and of itself,
fantastic,
and Help, was just like, it was amazing for most of us here in the States who are never going to get to see the Beatles live, that couldn't make it to Shea Stadium or wherever. That had a huge impact. But again, all that was still pop. And then as you got up through a couple of the later albums, all of a sudden everything got
incredible. Like, hey, man.
I know.
It's like everything takes off, and you see an Elvis movie from 1966, and you see what they're doing in 66, and you think, as much as I adore Elvis, we can talk about the comeback special, because I wrote it. You know, when Elvis sort of reclaimed some cultural ground. But watching Hard Day's Night is, George Harrison is 21 years old, and all this is happening. George Harrison, just 27, when it's over. He's finished at 27, and, you know, I don't know what you were doing at 27.
I know. But,
you know, I was still learning to tie my shoes or something. You know, when Harrison's just played on Abbey Road, it seems incredible. When I went to Bath 3 weeks ago, I got off the plane at Heathrow, and I took the train into Paddington. You go into Paddington, then you go out to Bath. And I got to Paddington, and I missed my train because I was walking around going, they filmed Hard Day's Night here, man.
Right.
They filmed
right.
Hard Day's Night here. And even though it's been renovated and all the rest of it, it's still where they filmed Hard Day's Night. And I thought, you know, it's 55 years ago. And here I am walking around going, and you know, they here's where they filmed that, you know, that opening scene, Harrison's, you know, when Harrison trips and all that. Yeah.
What's amazing for me is that there are moments when the music, you know, that first guitar bang.
Yeah.
That yep. It still sends yep. chills down your spine.
Yeah, it does. It does. It's
now you wrote an essay, and I want to talk yep. about this because it okay. was this was a fascinating event. This is the so-called rooftop concert.
Right.
When did it occur?
It occurred in January 1969. I've written quite a few articles for the Conversation. And it was, I don't know, October, November of last year. And I thought, I really should write. I would like to write something again. I like doing them. And I thought, what am I going to write on? And then I thought, you know what? Now, January is the 50th anniversary of the rooftop concert. And so I wrote my editor and I said, you know what the world needs? The world needs an essay on on that concert. And of course, on the day it happened, the world was swimming in essays. I thought I would be like the only one who noticed it. It was Thursday, January 30th, 1969. And I was struck immediately. I live in Canada. You live in Boston. I thought the rooftop concert was maybe some other time. It's the middle of, well, in North America, or parts of North America, what you would call winter. And there they were up on the roof, and they went out and they played for 42 minutes to friends, and you know, at the end Lennon says thanks Mo, and that's Ringo Starr's wife and their employees, and then you see all these office workers coming out of their office to see what's going on, and you don't really, you know, nobody knows at that point, of course, that this is the last time they're going to be together in public. It's not
that's
the last
right.
time they play together, but it's the last time we saw them together. It's the last time we saw George Harrison and John Lennon and Paul McCartney singing harmony together. And in the essay I say it's, you know, it's a gusty, cold afternoon, and you know, they're getting progressively colder and all the rest of it. But man, when they start, is that ever a band that's together? They just sound to me like, you know, it's a sort of a stressful time within the band and Harrison.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. And yeah. you talk about that in the essay.
Yeah.
The band at that point was really not getting along.
Yeah, Harrison, I mean, I've always wondered, why is Lennon playing the solo on Get Back?
Right.
And the answer is because Harrison got irritated and walked out. And so they were learning it, and Lennon took the solo. And when Harrison came back 3 or 4 days later, you know, it was Lennon's solo. It's pretty well documented that Billy Preston plays the, you know, the magnificent piano solo on Get Back, and Harrison asked them to join the sessions because they were squabbling and people weren't on their best, how they survived any of it, I don't know. So this is not a criticism, but they were not getting along as well as they had. And they go up on the rooftop, and I always think, oh, you know, the strains within the band are going to show. And I suppose in a way they do. I mean, Lennon's standing in the middle instead of over on the right, as he usually is. And Harrison seems a little bit disaffected, and there's a fifth Beatle there, person
yeah.
there, Billy, you know, the great, great Billy Preston, who's 22 years old. When they start Get Back, all five of them are, you know, they sound to be like completely invested.
Don't
in
they do three versions of Get Back on the concert?
They do it three different times, yeah. They do it three different times. Yeah, you know, McCartney's got the beard, and Preston is sort of tucked in the back. But I really wanted, when I wrote the essay, you know, that when I first thought, this is a good idea, and then I thought, okay, what are you going to say, Robert? And part of what I thought, you know, because all you just want to say is, oh, my God.
Before we get to Billy Preston, I want to yeah. talk about how the public learned about the concert, because those were the days before digital media. I didn't learn about the concert until later.
Yeah. Well, the public didn't know anything about it at all. And that's why people are clambering up on the roof and craning their heads up from the street below. They're just way up on a rooftop, and there's no publicity at all. It's supposed to be part of a film that they're trying to make, Let It Be, and McCartney says, you know, we need to do something, and, you know, we need to crown this film in some way, so let's work in the studio, and then we'll go stand on the rooftop, and we'll play. And they were going to go to Greece, and they were going to go, you know, they were going to go all over and film some concert, and in the end, it sort of speaks to what was happening with the band. They just said, oh, the hell with it, we'll just go up on the roof, which is what they did. But there's something quite wonderful about that as well. And so, no, it's not like announced the Beatles are playing. They just go out and play, and you start seeing all these London, you know, bobby policemen coming, and finally the policemen go up on the roof and shut them down because they're playing very loud music. But hey, it's the Beatles.
So well, you know, what's amazing is that, you know, rooftop concerts nowadays, you know, people like U2 and a bunch of other bands have done it. But this is the first time anything like this happened.
Yeah. I mean, like so often, you think, who did that before? And, you know, the answer is nobody. Nobody, at least nobody that I know, you know, decided that was a way of, you know, delivering your latest series of songs. Get back. And they played, I don't know, I just love Don't Let Me Down. I've always loved
Don't
that
Let
song.
Me Down.
It's got a 5-4 beat in it. And you know, in one of the versions, Lennon forgets the words. And it's just wonderful. He just doesn't know what he's. And he sort of looks over at McCartney, and there's this magical moment where you think, you know, I know they're not getting along, but there's also something that connects them on a pretty deep
level. There's a history.
Yeah. There's a pretty, yeah. I mean, you know, and they play one after 99, which they wrote when they were, you know, it's like from the 50s. Yeah, it's just a spectacular
thing. I can remember the first time I saw film stills and then segments of this concert, and just the way they looked and that they were dressed, there was a feeling like, wow, they really grew up and they're really moving on, and this is the end of the Beatles. This is it.
It's in that sense, it's quite hard to watch, right?
Yeah.
You know, Lennon said all the time, you know, when are the Beatles going to get back together? And my favorite Lennon response is, when you go back to high school. Right.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to go back to high school? Because I don't want to go back to high school.
No, I don't. And I.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. I don't want. I didn't particularly like it then. I wouldn't like it now. So you know, fair enough. So they grew up and they moved on.
Now let's talk about Billy Preston. How did Billy Preston get to be there?
Well, he's in London. He stops into the Apple Studios, and Harrison goes out in the lobby, and there's Billy Preston, and he says, why don't you come and join us? You know, thinking, I think at some level, that'll put people on better behavior. We're sniping each one at one another, and, you know, we'll get along better. You know, Peter Jackson's making a film about this period, and one of the things that's leaked out is they were actually getting along much better than people think they were, and I think that sort of shows through in the rooftop concert, even for the strain. So it'd be fascinating to see this movie. It wasn't quite as, you know, acrimonious as maybe it's been represented. But Preston was there to, you know, to make them behave a little bit better. And also, he's a superb piano player.
You also talked about the fact that he was gay, and gay. But at that time, that's a big deal.
That's a big deal. And, you know, I'd say in the essay, you know, they knew Brian Epstein was gay. And then, you know, they said, who cares? You know, they take part of what I'm trying to get across in the essay is that the reason the Beatles have such spectacular growth, the reason it's 50 years later we're still talking about them, is because they just opened themselves up to every influence they could soak up. And so that means they, you know, they're listening to Eastern music and you know, they're experimenting with everything. And that means that their music just gets more complicated and richer and more diverse all the time. And so it's typically and completely in character with the band that they would take a young, black, American gay man and say, well, I don't care. He's the best piano player around. Let's have him. And that kind of openness and that kind of acceptance is, you know, there's all kinds of things I think we can talk, we can learn, we can speculate about. The band let, you know, when Harrison comes and says, I've got a sitar, they don't say, well, we don't play sitars. They say, well, where can we use that? Well, that kind of creativity, especially among four people, you know, that's just, you know, the Beatles symbolize what four people can do if they sit in a room and, you know, listen to one another.
Well, I want to talk about another essay before we run out of time, and we are going to run out of time. You have a great essay on John and Yoko visiting Canada. They visited Canada three separate times.
Yeah.
And sort of a crusade for peace.
That's right. In 1969, they came to Canada three different times. You know, there's a bed in Montreal. Christ, you know, it ain't easy. And then there was a concert they played with Clapton at Toronto's Varsity Stadium, which is right on the University of Toronto campus. I've been there, you know, every time I walk by, I think, oh, my God, they were there. And then they come again in December to meet Trudeau. They want to talk to our prime minister. His son right now is prime minister.
That's Canada, right.
The father, Pierre Trudeau, was, well...
What was that meeting like? I mean, I can't imagine.
I mean, I grew up. I've sort of reached political consciousness under Trudeau because, as you know, in the Canadians, it's me to be prime minister as long as you keep winning elections. And so Trudeau was prime minister from the late 60s to 1984. He's prime minister for 16 years. And so, you know, I mean, America developed a political system that, you know, prevented that. But we still have the British system. So Trudeau was there was Trudeau mania in 1967. Trudeau.
Oh, I remember. I remember Trudeau mania. I really do.
Yeah. Well, and Trudeau was, you know, if you're someone who, I admire Trudeau immensely. And it was characteristic of Trudeau that he said, yeah, I'll talk to John Lennon, and I'll talk to Yoko Ono. And so they met and discussed peace. And Trudeau began the conversation by telling Lennon that he'd read his books. And Trudeau was a very, very smart, literate man. And it's completely in character that Trudeau would read, you know, the two books that Lennon had published, and they sat and talked. He was the only world leader that met John and Yoko. They wanted to see. Well, they couldn't, as you know, they couldn't even get into America really because of the drug bust. And so it's an example of you know, the Beatles connecting on an international stage. And I was just very interested in the impact they had in Canada and why they chose Canada and what they said about Canada. And that is 50 years ago this December.
Now, there were plans for a big, massive peace concert outside of Toronto. What happened?
That's right. Well, you know, then a month after that, Lennon records Instant Karma. But then...
Which is ostensibly his best solo song.
I love that song. I just think it's fantastic. He wrote it in a record time in the morning, went and recorded in the afternoon, and out it came. The Beatles are still together, but I think Instant Karma is... you know, a really exciting song. And Lennon sings it. I just love Lennon's voice. You know, and then McCartney breaks him up in 1970, or McCartney says he's leaving in April 1970. So Lennon has got plans for this sort of Woodstock-like event in Canada. And Trudeau gets caught up in a political crisis, and Lennon gets caught up in all kinds of friction, both with Apple and within his relationship with Yoko, and you know, it just, the peace movement sort of gets away from him, and it doesn't happen.
But there was a Trudeau peace initiative.
There was a Trudeau peace initiative toward the end of his premiership. Trudeau went and spoke to, at that time, Ronald Reagan. He went to China. He went to Moscow. And one of the things that I speculate about in my essay is that Trudeau was always very interested in peace movements. Lenin chose very wisely when he chose to speak to Trudeau. And after Trudeau had been prime minister for several years, he went on this peace initiative. And it's one of the things I've always really admired about Trudeau. He, you know, in the early 80s, he set out to say we should be talking about peace rather than war. And maybe it's just complete speculation, but I sort of feel like something of what Lennon achieved in that conversation set that in motion in Trudeau's mind. I'm speculating, but Trudeau nevertheless did it, and they talked in that meeting about peace. So I like to think that Lennon's impact, you know, spreads far and wide.
Now, one of the things you address in the essay, and I thought this was really interesting because it's very true, that at the time, a lot of people sort of felt that John and Yoko were being sort of naive, that this whole peace effort and these little demonstrations and, you know, the song Give Peace a Chance and stuff like that, okay, yeah, you did it, but it's not going to really accomplish anything. But you have a very different take on it.
Well, I think cynicism is very, very simple. And, you know, it's 50 years ago, and who doesn't think we'd need to talk more about peace? And, you know, when you listen to the ballad of John and Yoko, Christ, you know it ain't easy. You know how hard it can be.
Yep, yep.
The way things are going, they're going to crucify me.
But, you know, remember at the time, there was already a lot of anti-Yoko backlash.
Yeah.
It was really true.
Yeah, I understand, but I think...
And there are still people who blame Yoko for breaking up the Beatles.
I know. We have a very famous Canadian band called Bare Naked Ladies. And
Oh, yeah.
And they sing a song about John and Yoko, which is very, very clever and worth listening to. But I think it's also because Lennon is campaigning against Vietnam. And, you know, I just watched that Netflix show on Woodstock, and you can see the parallel, the brilliant documentary on Woodstock, and you can see, you know, the horror of Vietnam. Canada, you know, Trudeau said, we're not going to Vietnam, and Canada didn't go. But America was there, and Lennon is protesting against that, and there are forces then as now that want to keep voices like that quiet.
Well,
Lennon's got a lot of courage, man. I mean,
as you write about it, I mean, at least he's doing something. You know, like he was exploring different avenues of how to deal with war and protest it, and so they tried different things.
Yeah, and so it did. So he didn't, you know, he didn't stop Vietnam, but nor did he do nothing. And out of that, a song like Imagine arises. Lennon's got courage. And, you know, I know there's a new biography out, and I know he was, you know, there's things to be said that don't show him in the brightest light or the most flattering light. But given what he went through and where he started, you know, he spoke up for things. We have a Canadian rock musician who's recently died, named Gord Downie of the Tragically Hip,
and which you wrote another great essay about.
Which I wrote about. And Gord, you know, Gord Downie also stood up for in Canada, you know, the rights of Indigenous peoples and the history of Indigenous peoples. And you know, I'm one of those people who believes that rock and roll can achieve that. It can bring to consciousness ideas and resistance that I think is desperately, badly, always needed.
We're going to have to end on that note. Now, I hope while you're away...
I said 6%.
I know.
What I wanted to say.
I know that. But you know what? I hope you still write a couple of essays on rock while you're away.
Yeah, I will. Wow, I'm going to England.
I know. So I expect a whole ream of essays written while you're soaking in the atmosphere.
Well,
right
there. You are. I'll be sitting in the back of a pub writing about rock and roll.
Well, you know, I mean, Strawberry Fields is going to be open up by the time you get there.
There you go. Fantastic.
My returning guest tonight is
a pleasure to speak to you.
Oh my God. My returning guest tonight is Robert Morrison. He's a professor of English language and literature at Queen's University in Ontario. Now in Bath. He's going to be in Bath for the next 4 years, but he'll be back. And we've been talking about his incredible essays about rock and roll. While you're waiting for more of them to come out, and what's the online journal again?
It's called The Conversation. If you just type, Robert Morrison, The Conversation, you'll get it, or Robert Morrison, The Beatles, you'll get it.
He's got a great essay on The Tragically Hip. He's got a great essay on all sorts of stuff. On Elvis.
And I have to say, I don't know if it's a great essay, but an essay on Rod Stewart.
And about a specific song by Rod Stewart.
About a specific song called The Killing of Georgie.
I love that.
Yeah.
And that's more stuff we could talk about later. So I hope you're going to stay in touch. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about
welcome.
This.
Call me in Bath.
When you get back, maybe you can come on my rock show.
I'm there, man.
Okay, I know you are. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.